This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I'm David Canfield, and I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
So today we are talking about Shogun and the limited series race. I'm going to have a conversation a little bit later with Joy Press, Vanity Fair's television correspondent. Richard, you have not yet finished Shogun, so you will not be partaking, but I know you're a big fan of the show.
I really like it. I just don't want to be spoiled. And that's a fair warning to anyone listening that there will be spoilers in Joy and David's conversation.
We'll have an official warning at that point as well. But yes.
Yeah, okay, good.
Everyone be careful. The show is finished airing, so we're all fair game. But before we get into that, Richard, we're going to talk about Challengers, the film hitting theaters on Friday, and one that is a whole lot of fun at a time when I think we all really need it at the movies, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's weird that you and I would be interested in like a bi-curious tennis movie from the director of Come
By Your Name. Yeah, we're a little outside of our comfort zone right now.
But yeah, this is Luca Guadagnino, who did Call Me By Your Name, Suspiria, other things. And this is his second film set in America, which I find interesting. And really his first film that feels like an American genre movie. Like, it's a sports drama. And I think in my review, I compared it to Bull Durham, if it was directed by a gay Italian who had a flair for the dramatic. And I think he pulls it off.
So, yeah, this is Guadagnino's second American set film. And this one, we open on a tennis match between two young professionals played by Mike Feist and Josh O'Connor. There is a woman played by Zendaya who is watching them, and the camera seems very interested in her watching them. Mm-hmm. And over the course of the film, we come to learn about this very heated romantic triangle. It goes all the way back to the three of them in high school where they met. It has one very hot, if not quite explicit, scene between the three of them. It's a movie about sex and power plays and tennis, a lot of tennis.
Yeah. And I think that Guadagnino has said that he doesn't really care for tennis, which is interesting because he films it really well. I think tennis actually is a good sport for movies. It's, you know, the camera just moves back and forth. It's got good sound, the ball hitting the racket and all that. But he adds something kind of extra to it. Maybe it's just all the slow-mo shots of Mike Feist and Josh O'Connor grunting and sweating that made it seem like especially interesting. But lying underneath that, yeah, is a story about a love triangle, sexual dynamics as they evolve over the years. It is, as I mentioned, bi-curious, but it's mostly about these two men kind of warring over Zendaya's character, who is a former tennis star who has an injury and then becomes one of their coaches. And so it's really about two mostly straight men vying for the affection of, you know, this one woman.
I should go.
Wait, are you on Facebook?
What?
He's asking for your number. And so am I.
You both want my number?
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm not a homewrecker.
We don't live together.
It's an open relationship.
Also, Patrick has a girlfriend.
I do not. Hey, come hang out with us later. They put you up at the hotel in Flushing, right? We're in room 206.
Want me to come tuck you in?
No. We just keep talking. About tennis.
Good night.
We have beer.
Okay.
The performances in this movie, I really enjoyed. For me, Josh O'Connor was a real standout. It felt like a new kind of role for him. He's playing the swaggering, kind of messy member of this trio, whereas Mike Feist is a lot more buttoned up. He's the more professionally successful of the two men, at least. How did you find the three of them working together? Who stood out to you?
I mean, I think they're all three of them great. I mean, they have such a good rapport with one another. The scene you referenced, the hot scene that has been heavily touted in the trailers, is just like electric. I would watch them, the three of them, do a lot of other stuff together in movies, you know, if they wanted to act. I meant acting, acting.
Performance.
Or do I? I think that they're all three of them at different sort of levels of their career. Mike Feist, you know, is a Broadway guy who slowly moved into film. He was in the West Side Story film. He turned down Dear Evan Hansen. He was the only other original cast member asked to be in the movie. And he said no, which I think was probably the wise choice. And Josh O'Connor is maybe a little further ahead of him. People know him from God's Own Country. He's in La Chimera, which is in art houses now, I believe. And then, of course, Zendaya is Zendaya. And so I kind of went in thinking that it would be, you know, sort of evident that O'Connor and Feist are sort of struggling to keep up with the star event that is Zendaya. But they really work as peers and equals in it, even if the story, you know, has them at different levels of power. Yeah, I think they're great. I mean, I think my big question is, you know, this was supposed to be the opening night film at the Venice Film Festival last year, but it was pulled because of the strikes. Mm-hmm. If you have Zendaya in a movie, you really want her to be able to promote that movie. And so it's gone from potential fall awards movie into spring kind of fun thing. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, had it come out in the fall and Amazon/MGM had done an awards campaign for it, which they probably would have, like, where would they kind of position people? Who would they focus on most? And Zendaya would be the obvious answer, but I think between the two guys, they would go with Feist. What do you think?
I think they'd go with O'Connor. That's interesting.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But to what you were saying earlier about having Zendaya as the marquee of this movie and wondering, like, will they be able to keep up? I think that really serves her well, to the fact that they match her. Mm-hmm. And I'd never seen her play a role this adult, perhaps, before. Obviously, it spans a lot of time, so we do. Yeah. See, you know, we're introduced to the character as a teenager, but she is kind of ferocious as she gets really deep into this sticky triangle where she holds a lot of power and at the same time, very little power. It's fascinating to watch those pongs go back and forth around her.
And in terms of, like, grown-up roles, like, I think the only analog would be Malcolm and Marie, the Sam Levinson film. And she's fine in that. I mean, I don't like that movie, but, like, her performance here in Challengers just goes to show you what she can do with the right script. She gets to play an adult and have a lot of forceful lines and pointed banter and all that, similar to Malcolm and Marie, but here it just works so much better and she seems much more comfortable. And yeah, it's a really good transition film. I mean, she starts the movie as a teenager and then she's also playing someone in their early 30s, and I think it's a really good transition role into, like, more grown-up parts for Zendaya.
Wow, Malcolm and Marie. I'm really flashing back to, what was it, February 2021? I remember that release month because it was a late stage Oscar campaign. That to me felt like a high school movie, and she gave a very good performance in it within that context, which is to say it didn't feel as shaped or refined as what we know she can do. And even what we knew she could do back then, it was not something that I was impressed by really in any way. That's a tough movie to remember. To your earlier question about the awards trajectory for this movie, it's a really unusual one because I feel like the buzz around it when it was opening night, Venice Bound, was almost like Saltburn-esque, like not necessarily an awards movie, but this will be a really fun time. And it's like, you can't kick off Venice any better. It's got a lot of critical heat behind it as it's hitting theaters, and I think it's going to do well. I mean, I'm not, you know, up to date on the tracking with this one, but it just feels like there's a lot of noise around it.
There's a lot of noise around it for obvious reasons. I mean, Zendaya being the chief one, but also that trailer is very effective. It promises something exciting and sexy. I do wonder generationally how it will be processed. I mean, it does court mild taboo, I guess, in a way that certain members of Gen Z seem a bit allergic to. Not to paint with too broad a brush, but I'm curious to see what the sort of word of mouth on it will be. I think it'll do well in this opening weekend, but I could see people being like, well, that was weirder than I thought it was going to be, and I don't like the ending, and, you know, there could be myriad complaints about it, but I hope that it connects, because I think that it coming out in the spring does a good job of differentiating challengers from an awards movie or from a big tentpole blockbuster. It is one of those rare things that's kind of in the middle, much like Saltburn would have been if it had come out in the spring. I think that movie was sort of weirdly tainted by its awards association, its Telluride premiere. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt that the Challenger's premiere at Venice would have been great, but it would have put a kind of different framing on the movie that I'm sort of glad it doesn't have now.
And a summer release or a spring release, as we've seen over the past few years, especially with movies like Barbie, Everything Everywhere All at Once, movies that might not necessarily fit into that category as neatly, it gives them the runway to figure out what kind of campaign they're going to run. So I do think this is a movie we're going to be talking about in the fall. I also just want to talk about Luca Guadagnino a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a filmmaker who was one of my favorites, kind of up to Call Me By Your Name. He had a few movies in the late 2010s that I was not as high on. And, you know, it's weird to say about a cannibal movie, but Bones and All, to me, was quite muted. This feels like a return to form in a lot of ways and just made with incredible energy, to say nothing of that score by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
Yeah, the score, I mean, really is the fourth character. You know, it's
maybe
it's
the third.
yeah. Ross and Reznor do this thing where sometimes the music is this big electronic kind of pulsing thing that will play pretty loudly during big scenes of dialogue. And then other times there's this kind of lilting piano, similar to their work for My Beloved Empire of Light. It really adds a lot. And I think seeing Guadagnino work in such high style like that, I mean, it brings to mind, I mean, it's not quite I Am Love level, it's on the way to that in a way that Bones and All certainly wasn't. And I agree. Bones and All was sort of a misfire for me. But yeah, this finds Guadagnino kind of happily straddling commercialism in the United States with his signature artistic sensibility.
Mm-hmm. This movie is being handled by Amazon MGM Studios. I would imagine they are very happy with the reviews so far. And if we do see a box office breakout, I imagine this is one we'll be talking about a lot more.
Yeah, and I could see a few think pieces. I mean, I mentioned in my review that I think that Zendaya's character does recede into the background maybe a little too much toward the end and becomes something of an object that the two men are fighting over. And I didn't love that. I wish they'd kind of kept her as an equal in the triangle. But, you know, I'm sure we'll see some pieces about that. But I hope that most of the buzz is good, because more movies like this, please, please, please.
Could not agree more. And yeah, I completely agree with you about Zendaya. And the score is great. At times it is doing a lot of work. And I wonder how that will be received by a more general audience.
I feel like some of that score is going to make its way into a TikTok sound, and it's going to play loudly over
everything.
Things.
Yeah.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz. We should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/littlegoldmen today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/littlegoldmen. So with that, let's turn to Shogun. Saying up front, there will be a lot of spoilers of this series. Now that it is fully streaming on Hulu, we really want to get into the finale, everything that came before it. So I'm joined by Joy Press, our TV correspondent. Hi, Joy.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Joy, you cover television in all forms for Vanity Fair, and it's fitting we have you to talk about what maybe the biggest show of the year so far, at least in a sort of prestige-y, Emmy-bound circle. The show just ended its run on Tuesday. It's been charting really consistently in Nielsen streaming rankings. It's a critical hit. So I guess to start, let's just throw it out there. What did you think?
You know, it's a pretty spectacular show. It is the kind of prestige television show that you don't get as much as you did a few years ago and might be, you know, one of the last of its kind. It's really an immersive, slow burn kind of series. And yeah, I ended up loving it.
So this is adapted from the James Clavell novel from 1975, which was previously adapted into a miniseries in 1980, the kind of big ticket network miniseries event that definitely no longer exists. But with that, you have an update that I was really skeptical of when it was first announced, but really subtly and I think ingeniously reframes certain perspectives and maybe issues with the source material by centering the Japanese perspective a little bit more. And that goes both for the actual characters and I think the customs and the tensions that really fuel the show. Maybe, Joy, you can lay out who our players are here and how you observed these subtle shifts that I think really make the show as successful as it is.
Yeah, I think in the original miniseries, the central character was this white British sailor who arrives in Japan, Blackthorn. And in the contemporary version, he is not at all the central character. I mean, he's certainly, one of the main characters, but he serves as a little bit of a viewpoint for the viewers who are arriving in this very different, complicated, feudal world. And he kind of decodes the rituals along with us. But the main characters are really Lord Torunaga, who is one of five lords who are fighting over the future of the kingdom after the death of the previous leader. And then there's this Lady Mariko, who is one of his vassals, but a really brilliant woman who becomes Blackthorn's translator. And so it becomes a very different kind of story that really, really immerses us in this world. The characters speak Japanese. He has to figure it out and learn it as he goes along. And, you know, it really doesn't kind of dumb things down for us. We really are kind of thrust into this world and kind of watch it unfold at this stately pace.
He asks, what do you seek here?
To vanquish our common enemies.
Tekito
My master says you should not war against the Portuguese in Japan. You are outnumbered. It is hopeless.
Unless I win.
己が勝てば望みはあると申しておりまする。
Richard had compared the show to Downton Abbey, which I found so fascinating because of exactly what you're talking about. There is this immersion that's quite inviting into exactly that level of detail that is so specific to this time and place and even characters, because they are, even for the period, unique in their own ways. And I don't know, for me, there was something rather soothing about that, the fact that you felt like you were in such confident hands. And what did you make just of the level of detail? And I wonder if you could put it in some context of this scale of miniseries that typically does not have this level of specificity at the same time.
It's funny. I would never have thought of Downton Abbey. I think it's a really interesting comparison. The thing that I kept thinking about weirdly was The Wire. Which, I mean, completely different world, but the way that it sort of very slowly builds with the level of detail and the intricacy, the building of characters in this very, very subtle way. It's a very subtle show, and it's a very subtle culture. It's also the thing that bears comparison to Downton Abbey is, like, there's this immense sense of duty and place, hierarchy, and the way that it kind of builds those characters and the spectacular visuals, not just the incredible sort of fight scenes and battle scenes, but I sometimes felt like every scene was like a painting. It just is sort of breathtaking to watch the lighting. So, you know, it can sometimes be lulling because you're watching this beautiful thing and then it's sort of punctured by, you know, bouts of beheading.
There's a pivotal scene in the finale on a cliffside that is just so unbelievably stunning to look at. And the combination of that with, you know, really, really important and character-defining dialogue is, to me, the best kind of TV you can get.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I was thinking by the end, you know, you've kind of got a little of everything. You've got this great culture clash narrative of these kind of Westerners, you know, in this land that they don't understand and that doesn't understand them. You've got a succession struggle, you know, which definitely has, you know, meant that it gets compared to Game of Thrones, you know, and then you also have this lovely romantic storyline that plays out throughout. And then these amazing battles, which are spectacular. So yeah. It has a little bit of everything.
It's worth noting that specificity we're talking about, if you read interviews with the creators, Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks, or much of the cast, big credit went to Hiroyuki Sanada, who plays Lord Torunaga in just an unbelievably contained and intensely focused performance. It is the kind of role that a guy who has been acting in Hollywood productions for a very long time has too long been denied, you know, in the samurai culture, but with that level of depth and nuance that you crave because you know he can deliver it. But he would change every detail on the set. He would be the first one on set. He would make sure everything was just so, everything was just right. I believe he filmed for one day in 2019 as FX was trying to hold on to the rights and they were trying to make this the best show it could be. His level of commitment at the top of the ticket is really what you feel top down, I think.
Well, you know, David, you did an interview with Sanada where he was talking about wanting to create a very authentic portrait of feudal Japan. And it made me think about there's an episode of The Sympathizer in which the main character becomes a consultant on a Vietnam War movie. And, you know, none of the Vietnamese characters have any lines. And maybe that was a little bit more like the original miniseries adaptation of Shogun, you know, with the story very much seen through the British character. And this really is the complete opposite. I mean, it feels like the details are subtle and grounded. And that really plays into the plot line as well, because Torunaga holds everything so close to his chest. Each of them do. So when things happen, sometimes you could never have seen it coming.
I actually mentioned that to Sandra Oh in our Little Gold Men interview this week. She's a star of The Sympathizer, and it feels to me that these shows are in conversation with each other in a really interesting way because of exactly what you say. I'd love to go into that Game of Thrones comparison you mentioned a little bit. It's been thrown around a whole lot. In some ways, it's very obvious why, if only just for the sheer impact that this show has had, the fact that it has cut through the noise in a way most limited series just cannot these days. What I found really striking about it, and I'd love to talk about episode 9 in this context, because Game of Thrones was very known for its spectacular penultimate episodes in which you would have these big character deaths, you'd have these explosive sequences. We have a big character death with Mariko in a really amazing performance by Anna Sawai, but it felt almost subversive in the way that those conflicts came to a head. I was wondering if you felt the same way.
Yeah, I think it is kind of subverting the narratives all the way through. And the way that Mariko's death plays out is so tied to the kind of way that she lives her life, you know, with this immense sense of duty, but also this very poetic sense of approaching life and death, right? And making something kind of noble and useful of her death. I mean, her greatest power is, you know, making this statement, but it's an absolutely shocking moment in the series.
She and Blackthorne have a romantic connection over the course of the series. And this concept of, for her, what it means to die is something that you're questioning as a viewer, a Western viewer, right along with him. And in a way that I found really compelling and also very informative, right, is just eventually being able to watch the series on her wavelength and understand that the end game she has attempted to, and I think in the end successfully laid out for herself, is one that means a great deal to her, even if it is something that, you know, we cannot connect to as immediately, that Blackthorne cannot connect to as immediately. So it reinforces everything that is so moving to me about this show, which is that it is driven by custom. It is driven by how these characters viewed their place in the world in a way that never felt betrayed for the sake of narrative or contrivance.
Well, and it feels like she had so little control over her own life. And this is absolute control and absolute predetermination in a way. I mean, as we discover in the finale, she and Toranaga have kind of made a plan, and the plan works, and she is completely willing to die. And in fact, is, I think, at this point eager to die to be able to make that change and set the plan in action.
Well, as you can hear, listeners, we are big fans of this show. And it appears that many people are. It looks like a really strong Emmy contender. Joy, you cover the business of television a lot for us. And that is a big reason why I wanted to have you on this week, is because this show is in many ways a fascinating anomaly to me. The fact that it is, from my vantage point, the biggest swing FX has ever taken in material terms. But then it is also something that they took their time on and really made sure that they got right. What do you make of its success and its existence, really, within this ecosystem right now?
Yeah, I mean, it really is more a show that you might have imagined from classic HBO. Mm-hmm. And like Game of Thrones, maybe not, you know, at the time, the most obvious thing to take a giant swing on.
Right.
I mean, certainly when Game of Thrones came out, that was not in HBO's wheelhouse. And did seem very odd, but it feels very much like a classic miniseries of old, you know, these big sweeping historical roots and Holocaust. I think that it is possibly the biggest swing for FX, but also maybe a last gasp of the prestige television limited series. Streamers loved limited series because, you know, it was something that would lure subscribers, and it was awards bait. Stars were willing to make that shorter commitment. They, you know, would get a lot of money to have the star turn. But it's so expensive to make something like Shogun that, you know, I feel like we're going to be seeing a lot less of them as the kind of prestige era contracts.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
This whole Emmy race feels thrillingly out of time to me. In addition to Shogun, you have The Sympathizer, as you mentioned. Another show I could not imagine being made today for many reasons, including the fact that they have mostly unknown casts, or the fact that they are made on a significant budget, or that they are pay attention TV. You can't just be on your phone while they're on and follow along. It feels like in more ways than one, this is a real last gasp, and in a way, something we kind of have to treasure a little bit, because there's a lot of work here that is really special and kind of an endangered species.
Yeah, it definitely feels like we're not going to see a lot of limited series competitions like this again. I mean, maybe there'll be a few leftovers, but really the quality of roles and performances are pretty spectacular this season.
You mentioned this boom that happened about a decade ago, and a lot of credit can go to FX for the state of the limited series right now. We are actually at the 10th anniversary of Fargo's first Emmy win, and that was the season that you had both Noah Hawley's Fargo debut on FX with Billy Bob Thornton and this surprisingly successful take on the Coen Brothers movie that in retrospect... It worked, right? There have been many iterations that he's pulled off to varying degrees of success, but most of the seasons, I think, have been really, really wonderful. And you also had True Detective on HBO, which competed in drama because it thought it could beat Breaking Bad, and then it did not. It has since competed as a limited series, but same star-driven anthology concept. Before that, you had a much more traditional kind of John Adams-esque miniseries running the table. So what about that period changed the business? What about those shows and that time in television indicated that this was at least something worth experimenting with for a while, even though they were expensive and maybe not the broadest appealing?
Well, again, I mean, Fargo is FX, True Detective is HBO, and those two have been really anchors of the limited series and kind of pushing new ground in prestige. But I also think there was a real excitement over the last decade about breaking barriers and trying new things in general, not just in limited series, as we know, like in comedy and drama, that's been the case. But I think, interestingly, I mean, both Fargo and True Detective were anthology series that maybe seemed to be wearing out their welcome in mm-hmm. the previous seasons. And they both came back and did something new. I mean, particularly True Detective just reinvented itself this season. But I think Fargo also had an extremely strong season. And I think that's something that probably isn't going to go away, is the idea of taking something that's a familiar shell, that's a familiar format that audiences already recognize and coming and just sort of re-inhabiting them and like exploding them.
I'm just sort of happily picking your brain about various TV things at this point, but what do you make of Shogun being an FX production specifically? This is, you know, I don't want to say I grew up on FX, but certainly as someone who came to love TV at a younger age, there was an awareness of FX doing things that maybe weren't always appreciated at the Emmys or in prestige circles, but that were always creatively interesting. And Fargo obviously being a prime example of them leading the way, or something like The People versus O.J. Simpson a few years later winning the Emmy. They've always had a real hold. Of course, this was also a basic cable channel. And from my eyes, they've at least managed to stay relevant in the streaming era.
They really seem to invest in creators' visions in a way that few other streamers going forward may be doing, and I think are willing to take some leaps. I mean, these shows are all leaps, or were leaps when they started, and they're kind of really allowing them to go out on limbs in ways that hopefully will be rewarded when it comes time for awards.
hopefully there is an understanding too in Hollywood that Wish Shogun is a prime example of what you can achieve when you don't rush something, get it out there as quickly as possible, and really dedicate years to making it the best version of itself, because that is something that I associate with this brand, with FX, something a little bit more creative control, a little bit more quality control that harder to come by these days, maybe.
Absolutely. I think there's still plenty of great shows around. There certainly are less series being made now than there were, you know, say 3-4 years ago at the peak of peak TV, but there are plenty of shows to keep us occupied.
The other network I would love to talk about, as long as we're talking about the limited series categories, is Netflix. Netflix obviously takes a very different approach to their campaigns. They have a lot of resources, a lot of money, for the most part, a lot of eyeballs on their series, even more than on Shogun in most cases. This is an interesting year where this week, a little series called Baby Reindeer was announced to be officially submitted for limited series consideration. It's a bit of a phenomenon. It had very, very little push inside the awards team as of a couple weeks ago, as far as I could tell. It was a word of mouth phenomenon. And meanwhile, you had shows like Ripley, All the Light We Cannot See was getting screened for awards press truly about a year ago, over a year ago. What do you make of the way that that network is navigating this season?
Yeah, I mean, Baby Reindeer is a British production, as far as I know, and a lot of the time, those series don't get pushed. I mean, there's a lot of pickup of foreign projects, and it is a very dark, very disturbing show. It doesn't have tons of, you know, high production value. It's mostly set in a pub and in some of the dingier bits of London. and it's really very much focused on a stand-up comic and his stalker. So, you know, it's not an obvious blockbuster or an obvious awards contender, but the performances are pretty mesmerizing.
They are. And I will say, internally, people at Vanity Fair were talking about this show as screeners came in for months. And so it was one I had on my radar, not thinking it would be in that Emmy space necessarily, but just excited to watch it. So it was kind of gratifying to see so many people have that same reaction of, what is this show? At times, it almost gave me vibes of I May Destroy You, Michaela Cole's brilliant HBO series, because it is this show that straddles a kind of memoiristic realism with a really impressionistic and dark take on a personal trauma that I just found really moving to watch.
Yeah, I have to say, I did not think that it reached the level of I May Destroy Sure. You, which is a pretty masterful show. But I do think that it was done with such a strong voice, such mm-hmm. a strong narrative voice. And I mean, it's really through the perspective of this comedian. I feel like that is proof that if you provide something that has this incredibly strong narrative pull and you promote it on Netflix, you promote it on your top Netflix tile, people will find it. I think increasingly it's just hard for people to find some of these new things.
Yeah, I mean, this is a year where you have a lot of expensive, starry, limited series vying for, you know, a handful of slots, and the campaigns are all in motion. I'm wondering if there's anything that you really love that you hope is able to break through the noise, even if it may not seem as likely.
Yeah, I mean, I really fell in love with the Netflix show One Day, the limited series One Day.
Me too. I loved that show. We actually had Ambika Maud, who plays the female lead, on the podcast earlier this month to talk about this decade-spanning romance that really won us over.
Which, yeah, I mean, is, again, a British production, but sort of flew under the radar. You know, I don't know a lot of people who saw it. It's, you know, based on a novel. There was a movie, a not as good movie that was made some years ago of the same thing. And this was just so beautifully done, kind of a rom-com, but such a unconventional structure, fantastically well acted. And, you know, I hope people find it.
I hope they do too. It's a very different show from Shogun, but same sort of category of source novel that was a huge bestseller, source movie show, you know, initial adaptation that was a commercial hit, not necessarily as well received critically. And then you just get this really artful, beautifully acted, layered new take on it in ways that I just found really surprising. I watched it with my husband, I think, in two nights and was not well by the end of it. There were tears.
It is the cliche. You laugh, you cry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the other one is Expats on Amazon, which, you know, it has Nicole Kidman in it. Normally, you know, in some other era, that might have been a shoo-in. But again, I think it was beautiful, artful, subtle, and kind of flew under the radar.
That was a show that spoke to me. One of the other interesting dynamics that we've talked a lot about on the show with a number of these series is it's a very director-driven limited series race in some ways. And Expats, which we haven't talked about a lot, was fully directed by Lulu Wang, who'd previously directed the film The Farewell. And God, she has a vision for it. I mean, it is just stunning to look at. And again, there's a level of a vision that just swept me the whole way through.
Yes, that is auteur TV at its absolute highest level.
And that, again, it feels a bit out of style. It's another example of shows that we gotta recognize them while we can, because we are entering an uncertain new era.
That sounds very, very doomy.
Well, you know, we cover Hollywood, and it's not the sunniest time, but there is a lot of good stuff to talk about, at least. So to wrap, I'd love to go back to Shogun for a moment, Joy, and given that the finale just aired, and I think for you and me both, the show on paper was not something we were necessarily going to eagerly go into. It's something that we had to be convinced, and then quickly you realize you're in the hands of people who know what they're doing and, you know, watching something really special. Is there a way you would put it for people who are in that position now, as the show is now fully streaming on Hulu, to recommend that, yeah, they should go into it?
It definitely took me a minute at the very beginning. It definitely feels intense in the same way that, you know, it feels intense for Blackthorne, the English sailor who ends up adrift in Japan. It was really absolutely worth it to just immerse myself and let the narrative come to me.
That does it for this week's show. You can email us at littlegoldmen@vf.com, and you can always find us on the internet. I'm at DavidCanfield97, and Richard?
Rylaws.
And you can find Joy Press at Joy Press. Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best preview of what Rebecca Ford has been working on during her soon-to-end maternity leave goes to Richard Lawson.
The TikTok sound.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.